Hi everyone, thanks for listening to the Scandinavian History Podcast with me, Michael Schenkman. Last time, the King of Sweden had a mental breakdown and went on a murder spree, killing Nils Sture and having two other members of his family as well as some other people killed. But that wasn't the only thing he did when he was suffering from his little episode. When he recovered after a few months, he announced that he had married his sister's former maid, Karin Månsdotter, and that his new wife was pregnant. Apparently, he had given up on trying to marry Queen Elizabeth of England or some German princess. This time, we'll see how the dramatic news of the wedding and the pregnancy was received by Erik's family, and what they chose to do about it. Episode 81, Coup d'État. King Erik XIV of Sweden recovered from his episode of temporary insanity in December 1567 and took back control over his kingdom. One of the first things he did was to present his new-ish wife to the court. As we covered last time, the king had married his sister's former servant in July during his mental breakdown, a few weeks after ordering the murder of a handful of members of the high nobility, most notably the leading members of the Sture family. In Erik's mind, his only real rivals for the Swedish crown. The king's recovery was just in time to counter the Danish offensive deep into Swedish territory, which had started in October that year. King Frederick of Denmark wanted to take advantage of his cousin Erik's incapacitation by invading Sweden, trying to reach Stockholm and take over the country, re-establishing Danish control over all of Scandinavia. But it was a long way to Stockholm, and when the Danish army didn't get the reinforcements it needed, it had no choice but to turn around and start making its way back to Denmark again, burning and pillaging as they went. The Swedish forces followed the retreating Danes into Scania, but they never managed to catch up with them. So Frederick's army returned home more or less intact, but he'd failed at recreating the Kalmar Union. When the threat of a Danish invasion had been taken care of, Erik settled in the southern Swedish town of Jönköping in Småland for the winter. There, he took stock of what had happened while he had been out of commission, and he started to undo several of the council's key decisions. First of all, he declared that his trusted advisor and the prosecutor in the High Commission, Göran Persson, was innocent and released him from prison. This decision upset many in the high nobility who hated Persson. There were, no doubt, more than one who cursed the decision not to have Göran Persson executed while they had the chance. But few people dared to express such feelings openly to the king, and for good reason. One nobleman actually did question the decision to reinstate Göran Persson in his former position of power and influence. This made King Erik so furious that he actually beat the insolent nobleman to death with a poker. Once he was back in office, the king also instructed Göran Persson to take back all the money and property he'd given to Martha Sture as compensation for the murders of her husband and sons. It's unclear, though, how much of the money he managed to retrieve, because these funds, called the blood silver by Martha Sture herself, will make a comeback in this story in a few minutes. In the spring, King Erik returned to Stockholm, and he decided to return in triumph, having chased off both his ghosts and the Danes. The king entered the city in a procession containing soldiers, a band, Danish prisoners of war, captured banners, and Swedish knights on horseback. Very splendid. They marched through a temporary triumphal arch that had been erected especially for the occasion. The king's entry into Stockholm marked the beginning of a festive season that would center on Erik's expanding family. The first event on the agenda was the baptism of his and Queen Karin's newborn son. The boy, the new heir to the throne, was named Gustav after his grandfather. He was carried to the baptism by the Dowager Queen Catherine. The king's brothers, John and Carl, attended the baptism, as did several of their sisters. The next big-ticket item on the festive calendar occurred a month later. It was the public wedding of Erik and Karin. It's true that they had already tied the knot back in July of the previous year, but that had been a small secret ceremony. King Erik wanted a big and lavish event, a real royal wedding. He didn't seem to mind one bit that the bride came from a far more humble background than was customary at royal weddings. His brothers, John and Carl, on the other hand, did mind. They minded quite a bit. They minded so much that they chose to stay away from the wedding in protests. they weren't willing to accept the low-born Karin Mondsdottir as queen. The king's brothers may not have attended, but several of the bride's relatives had come. These peasants, dressed up in court finery, attracted a fair bit of attention from the other wedding guests, and not all of this attention was good-natured. Many of the members of the nobility also found the proceedings scandalous, but unlike the king's family, they hadn't had the guts to stay away. The following day, Karin Mondsdottir was crowned queen. King Erik was no doubt over the moon, but his brothers were less amused. This new family line that their brother had established threatened to undo all their father Gustav Vasa's hard work at creating a respectable royal family in Sweden. If John's and Carl's mother, Margaret, had been too low-born to be a royal bride, since she had only been of aristocratic stock, what could then be said of Karin Mondsdottir, a servant from a peasant family? If their son were ever to be king, this would threaten Sweden's standing on the international stage. The brothers, and especially John, had additional reasons to be angry at King Erik, for sure. I of course refer to the whole mess with the king arresting John for marrying a Polish princess and then locking them up at Gripsholm Castle for 4 years. If that wasn't bad enough, the Russian Tsar, Ivan the Terrible, was out to get John's Polish wife. Ivan had courted her in the past, and he wasn't willing to accept that she'd married the Swedish prince. The Tsar had written to King Erik and demanded that he hand over his sister-in-law to the Russians. If he didn't, he would risk the peaceful relations between Sweden and Russia. The Russians had even sent a diplomatic delegation to Stockholm, and they had been in the city for over a year, waiting to take John's wife with them back to Russia as soon as King Erik recovered from his insanity and would approve the request. These Russians were still in Stockholm. To John and Carl, the conclusion was clear. Erik had to go. Already when John and Carl attended the baptism of their nephew, Gustav, they were planning to overthrow the king. To finance this revolt against their brother, they had collected money from several sources. Royal officials, burghers, and even Uppsala Cathedral contributed. Martha Sture, Svante Sture's widow, gave the conspirators the blood silver she'd received in compensation for the murders of her husband and sons. The fact that so many were willing to chip in is a clear indication of how unpopular King Erik had become. Another indication of how few friends the king had left is that none of them told him what was about to happen. Despite his network of spies tasked with finding out what was going on, he remained clueless about the approaching danger. But it wouldn't be long before King Erik realized that something was up. Already a few days after the solemn coronation of Queen Karin, the king was informed that his brothers were planning to go abroad. Erik didn't like that, and since no member of the royal family was allowed to travel outside the kingdom without the king's consent, he sent out orders to stop them from crossing the border. But maybe he should have let them leave, because in mid-July, the king received even worse news. By now, the preparations were over. They'd gathered a military force willing to fight against the king, and an open revolt was declared. To begin with, the rebels had captured Vadstena Castle. King Erik reacted to the news by raising troops of his own and summoning the Council of the Realm to Stockholm, demanding that they condemn his brothers and sentence them to death. Remember, the war against Denmark was still technically going on at this point, even though 1568 was a bit of a gap year as far as the fighting was concerned. But still, Sweden was now involved in a foreign war and a civil war at the same time. Not the best position to be in, and frankly, the Swedes were lucky that the Danes were so weak at the moment that they weren't able to exploit the situation more. By the end of August, John and Carl and their troops were marching on Stockholm. King Erik, in turn, moved south to meet his rebellious brothers in the open field. At Nyköping, about 100 kilometers southwest of Stockholm, the two sides met in a battle that John and Carl won. Erik and his remaining troops fell back to Stockholm with the rebels in pursuit. In early September, the brothers had reached the city and put up camp on the Brunkeberg Ridge to the north. As you may remember, that had been the favorite spot for invading Danish armies that had wanted to capture Stockholm in the past. Behind the city walls, King Erik was gearing up for the final battle to crush his treacherous brothers, but few of the people around him shared his enthusiasm. One after the other, his courtiers and administrators started to abandon the king and join the rebels instead. Even members of Eric's own family, the Dowager Queen, his sisters, and his brother-in-law, snuck away to join John and Carl. In the end, the only family member left by Eric's side was Queen Karin. Still, the king refused to give up. But morale inside the city was flagging. The soldiers outside were calling over the walls for the defenders to hand over the hated Göran Persson to them, and on September 18th, the king's own men demanded that the request be met. They argued that the king's advisor was the root for the problem, and if Eric would just get rid of the hated prosecutor from the High Commission, maybe the conflict with his brothers could be solved peacefully. Eric refused, perhaps out of loyalty to Göran Persson, but perhaps also because he realized that sacrificing him wasn't enough to save his crown, not anymore. When the king refused to expel Göran Persson from the city, soldiers decided to take the matter into their own hands. They attacked the advisor's home and ransacked it. Göran Persson himself managed to escape and flee to the castle, where he hoped the king would protect him. Eric did what he could, but the soldiers burst into the castle as well and seized Persson, ignoring the king's order to let them go. They ripped the clothes off the hated royal advisor, then they beat him up before bringing him out of the city and handing him over to the rebels. Once Göran Persson was in rebel hands, his fate was sealed. He had enjoyed a meteoric rise, but his fall was to be harsh, painful, and protracted. He was tortured for days, but he refused to divulge any of the king's secret. In the end, he was executed in an elaborate and cruel way on September 22nd. First, his ears were cut off. Then he was hung from his waist in the gallows for half an hour. Then he was taken down and tied to four posts on the ground, where the executioner crushed his legs and arms. Apparently, Göran Persson behaved stoically throughout this horrible torture and didn't scream or complain. Only when the Duke Carl, the king's youngest brother, appeared did Persson beg him to cut short his misery and let him die. The 18-year-old Duke then ordered the executioner to cut Persson's head off, which he did. Once he was dead, the body was cut up into pieces, which were displayed on pikes within sight of King Eric's apartments at Stockholm Castle, so the king would know what had happened to his trusted advisor. When Göran Persson was arrested, the soldiers took his mother as well. They gagged her because they were convinced she was a witch, and they were afraid she'd speak some curse if she could. Now she was brought out to look at her son's dismembered body. According to the official account, she then fell off her horse and broke her neck, and was buried next to the place of her son's execution. According to another version, her body was dumped in a swamp further north. But she did die. Göran Persson's wife, who had also been hated in wide circles, fared better. She managed to escape to the archipelago between Sweden and Finland, where she could live in peace, but not in quite the same style as she'd grown accustomed to, because all of Göran Persson's estates were confiscated by the crown. Some of them would, however, eventually be returned to their children. One of Göran Persson's sons would actually end up working for Duke Carl, and he wrote a hagiographic history about Gustav Vasa. Now the king's trusted advisor, and quite possibly last ally, was gone. But Eric still refused to give up. Maybe seeing what his brothers had done to Göran Persson actually had hardened his resolve not to hand himself over to the rebels. God only knows what might happen to him if he did. But no matter how determined Eric was not to capitulate, it was really only a matter of time until the end. John and Carl commanded a superior number of troops. They controlled the whole country except Stockholm, and basically everyone involved in the running of the kingdom had deserted the king and joined the rebel camp. A week after the execution of Göran Persson, some people who thought the whole affair had gone on far too long already simply opened the city gates to the troops outside. The rebel soldiers swarmed into Stockholm, and at this point even King Eric realized that the jig was up. He fled from the castle and took refuge in St. Nicholas Church, a stone's throw away. There, he met his younger brother Carl and gave himself up. It was September 29th, 8 years to the day since Gustav Vasa had died and Eric XIV had become king. It was over. Eric had been deposed. But that was only the first step. Now the coup entered its next phase. John needed to justify the ousting of their brother and secure his own claim to the crown. He was clearly an established facts on the ground kind of guy, because the very day he entered Stockholm after his brother had been deposed, he started to style himself King John III. That was, however, a claim that was both presumptuous and premature. His older brother Eric may have been a bad king and no longer in control of the kingdom, but he was a crowned monarch nonetheless, and had therefore received the stamp of approval from God himself to rule over Sweden. And even if God agreed that Eric had lost his right to be king, he still had a son who was the recognized heir to the throne. In other words, John's claim to be king stood on quite shaky legal ground, and John knew it. He was in desperate need to legitimize his new position, and quickly. The Riksdag was to reconvene in January 1569, and John would have to convince the estates to vote to recognize him as king. Otherwise, he'd be nothing more than a simple usurper and traitor, and in that case, he'd be in quite a pickle. In preparation, John did what he could to justify the coup. He tried to convince everyone that Eric had been not only crazy, but dangerous. Eric XIV was described as a mad tyrant who had set up the High Commission to try and trap and kill all kinds of innocent people in order to increase his own power and wealth, well beyond what was acceptable. In the end, the official list of reasons to justify the coup mostly included things King Eric was accused of having planned to do, not things he'd actually done. John said Eric had planned to kill him and to send his wife Catherine to Russia. The reason he and Carl had stayed away from Eric's wedding ceremony wasn't at all that they didn't approve of the bride's low birth, but that the ex-king had actually planned the event to murder his brothers. But there were also a handful of accusations of things Eric had actually done. His decision to tax the nobility was described as an attempt to impoverish the kingdom and to loot it. And he was also accused of having hidden the vast fortune of the crown that his father Gustav Vasa had spent a lifetime amassing. The sad truth about that, though, was that Eric hadn't hidden any money. He had spent it all on the war against Denmark, and the crown was now more or less bankrupt. The Riksdag accepted John's description of events and confirmed that Eric XIV had been lawfully deposed and replaced as legitimate king by his younger half-brother, John, who could now legitimately use the title John III. On January 29, 1569, ex-King Eric was brought up from the silver vault of Stockholm Castle, where he'd been locked up since the coup. He was taken to the castle chapel, where, in the presence of his brothers, King John III and Duke Carl, the Council of the Realm, and representatives of the four estates, he was informed that he was no longer king, and that he and his offspring had lost the right to the crown. According to one, not totally reliable source, Eric reacted by shouting at John, "I was crazy one time when I agreed to release you!" But apart from cursing at his brother, there was nothing Eric could do. He'd been sidestepped and would be pushed into the margins of history. John's propaganda against his brother Eric had worked, and he was seen by everyone as a crazy, brutal, and bloodthirsty madman. That judgment would stand for hundreds of years, until some historians in the 20th century started to re-evaluate Eric XIV and look at the coup that brought John III to the throne with more skepticism. Still, even the most contrary historians concede that Eric was a troubled man and that he seemed to have suffered from some kind of psychological issue or other. Of course, it's impossible to know after all these years exactly what afflicted him, but that hasn't stopped some people from speculating. One theory is that Eric was schizophrenic, but we really can't know. What we do know is that his half-brother Duke Magnus also suffered from mental health issues and was locked up for parts of his life because he was confused and violent. The other brothers were also prone to suspicion and violence, as their father Gustav Vasa had been, so it may have been something that ran in the family. Even though he was now confirmed as the rightful king of Sweden, John III was still worried about what his brother Eric might get up to. He had not taken the whole being toppled thing well, and John was afraid that he might be scheming to get back on the throne, perhaps plotting with loyalists somewhere who'd break him out of his prison and then start a war to reclaim the crown. To make sure that would never happen, King John ordered the ex-king to be placed in isolation, away from his wife, children, and any other people that may want to visit him. John's worry about plots to reinstate Eric as king only grew after one such plot was discovered early on in his reign, already in August 1569. It turned out that none other than Frederick II, Eric's cousin and archenemy, had offered to help set Eric free and make him king again if he just promised to hand over Elfsborg Castle permanently and Varberg as well. Remember, the Northern Seven Years' War was still going on. At this point in time, the Swedes had managed to capture Varberg and used it as an alternative port with independent access to the North Sea. The Danes were really keen to lock the Swedes into the Baltic Sea, and Frederick thought it would be a bargain to help Eric back on the throne if he could achieve this goal. One suspects that King Frederick also thought it would be a great idea to have a mentally unstable and unpopular king on the Swedish throne, so he was all for helping Eric out if he could. Nothing came of this particular plot, though. It was discovered, and all the lower-level conspirators were executed. The plotters did achieve one thing, though. They managed to scare the living daylight out of King John. He issued an order to his brother's jailers, saying that if anyone tried to release Eric, they were to kill the former king immediately, without hesitation. And the people tasked with guarding Eric weren't just any old prison guards. No, that job was given to various nobles who had reasons to hate Eric. One of his jailers was the brother of one of the murder victims from the last episode. He hated ex-King Eric so much that he actually shot him in the arm once, and then refused him adequate treatment, resulting in Eric being lame in the left arm for the rest of his life. Another measure taken to minimize the risk of plotters bringing Eric out of prison was that he was often moved from one location to another. For a while he was kept in Turku in Finland, and then at Gripsholm, where John and his wife had been locked up. But even this didn't dissuade some people from trying to help Eric escape. In October 1574, he was held at a rundown castle north of Uppsala when yet another conspiracy to set him free was revealed. In the end, King John realized that he would never be secure in the throne as long as Eric was still alive. So he decided to do something about that. In mid-February 1577, Eric fell ill with pains in his stomach and chest. By February 22nd, he was in such a bad state that he could no longer get out of bed. 3 days later, on February 25th, at 2 a.m, he died. Even at the time, it was widely assumed that ex-King Eric had been poisoned, most likely with arsenic-laced pea soup. He was eventually buried at Västerås Cathedral, and when his grave was opened in 1958 and his remains analyzed, large quantities of arsenic were indeed found in his stomach and liver. So he was definitely poisoned. Unclear if it was in soup, though. Eric's wife Karin, the former maid who had become queen for a few short weeks, fared considerably better than her husband. She and her two children, Sigrid and Gustav, were taken to Finland, and when Eric died, she was released and given an estate there. She was no longer a threat after her husband's death, so she could now be treated with a certain amount of respect. She had been queen, after all. Her daughter, Sigrid, born before she and Eric married but later naturalized, had a pretty standard life for a member of the higher nobility. She was a lady-in-waiting to one of her cousins, John's daughter Anna, and Sigrid was eventually married off to a nobleman and lived a life of respectability and privilege. Her brother Gustav, on the other hand, wasn't so lucky. He was more of a problem since he was a man and could therefore make a claim for his father's throne. So when he was 7 years old, he was sent to Poland, the home country of King John's wife, Catherine. There, he spent his life in obscurity and poverty, and it would only get worse. In the year 1600, he traveled to Russia, where he was apprehended by the Tsar, who tried to convince Gustav to participate in some scheme aimed at undermining the stability of Sweden. When Gustav refused, he was sent into internal exile to a town some 200 kilometers north of Moscow, where he died a few years later. His mother, ex-queen Karin, outlived him and passed away in 1612 after 35 years as the lady of a grand estate in Finland. Her life as a widow had been comfortable, but she had been irrelevant on the national political stage. In the middle of that stage stood her brother-in-law, King John III. But the king was far from alone on that stage. Throughout his reign, John was dependent on the nobility. They had paid for the rebellion that put John on the throne, and they made sure he would never forget it. King John was also smart enough to show his gratitude. During his time on the throne, the Swedish nobility grew in power, in wealth, and in numbers. At his coronation, a few months after Erik was toppled, John created several new counts and barons. He also introduced permanent land grants to the nobility that would pass from father to son in noble families. This was a novelty in Sweden, because up until this point, all grants had reverted to the crown after the death of the holder. This new order increased the independence of the aristocracy and their ability to amass generational wealth. High noblemen were also given jurisdiction over the peasants who lived on their land and worked it. This was also something new in Sweden. In other words, Sweden became a classic European feudal society during the reign of John III, thus joining many other European countries, including Denmark, where things like permanent land grants and jurisdiction over peasants were old hat, and where feudalism had been the standard for several generations already. Next time, we'll have a closer look at some other things that John III did that had the potential to radically change Swedish society. But before we end today, I'd like to answer another question that I've received from a listener. This one's from Gunnar in Sweden. He asks why I talk about slaves in Viking Age Scandinavia instead of using the term thrall. Gunnar doesn't elaborate on why he thinks I should use the word thrall instead of slave, so I can only guess. Apologies in advance if my guesses miss the mark. If the question is merely why I refrain from using the local Scandinavian term thrall and thereby miss an opportunity to add some authentic color and character to the show, I could just answer that I'm avoiding it because I think it would be unnecessary to burden the narrative with obscure terminology that only a handful of listeners are familiar with. I don't set out to confuse people on purpose. If it happens, it's almost always unintentional. But I have a sneaking suspicion that Gunnar's question isn't merely one of linguistic preferences. Because there is also a tendency, at least in Scandinavia, to see the phenomenon of thralls as different and somehow more benevolent, or at least not as bad as slavery in other societies. And this is exactly the reason I use the word slave and not thrall. I do it on purpose to underline that slavery in Viking Age Scandinavia was no better or particularly different than slavery in other parts of the world. The buying and selling of human beings was a big part of the Viking economy, and people who were slaves in Scandinavia had similar legal and working conditions as those in other societies based on a slave economy. It's true that some slaves were treated well and formed close bonds with their owners, but that was true also in other places. And we have no reason to believe that the vast majority of Scandinavian slaves did not lead miserable lives filled with backbreaking labor, malnutrition, and abuse. The tendency to romanticize or at least downplay slavery is not limited to Scandinavia by any means. When discussing the Vikings, those who do tend to insist that there is some qualitative and essential difference between slaves and thralls, and that the former term shouldn't be used when talking about Scandinavian society. And that's exactly why I do it, to stress the essential similarities. So thank you for that question, Gunnar. I'm not sure why you asked it, but it gave me the opportunity to reiterate the point about Scandinavian slavery. I'm not sure whether you liked the answer or not, but if you didn't, feel free to write again to try and convince me that I'm wrong. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Scandinavian History Podcast, whatever your views on Viking Age slavery may be. If you did, why not spread the word wherever you congregate with others who are also into Scandinavian history? Also, please consider leaving a stellar review, or at least 5 stars, on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. This is an excellent way to attract new listeners and to support the show. Another good way to support the show is to purchase some Scandinavian history-themed merch in the Scandinavian History Podcast webshop. I especially recommend something from the Odin's Lifehack collection. It's a line of merch with quotes from Havamal, accredited to the King of the Gods. You can get t-shirts, mugs, tote bags, and many other items with nuggets of Scandinavian wisdom, such as, "Wake up early if you want another man's land or life," "Only fools hope to live forever by avoiding enemies," or "Speak useful words or be silent." Links to these amazing products and more can be found on the Scandinavian History Podcast Facebook page. If you haven't already, then please go to facebook.com/Scandinavian History Podcast. Like and follow the page if you want to shop, or if you just crave more content, at least vaguely relevant to Scandinavian history. Via the Facebook page, you can also send me questions or angry messages about things I've said or not said on the show. If you prefer Twitter, or X as it's called these days, then you can follow me and send me messages at Schenkman. That's S-H-A-I-N-K-M-A-N. I look forward to hearing from you.